In our practice and study, we begin to open to the fact of how vulnerable we are as human beings. Whenever I hear the talk, or I remember that first of the Four Noble Truths, that life is made up of all these places of painful and pleasurable moments that go away, painful moments that don't seem to go away. I remember that word vulnerability, and just how vulnerable we are born into this human life. The hallmarks of vulnerability in our life are birth. And it's a rare baby that comes out smiling, you know. It's hard to be born. Some of us probably in one way or another have remembered the birthing pains, you know, have gone back that far. Sometimes I think I have. I don't really know for sure, but yeah. And aging. Well, let's not forget the adolescent years. Those were really hard. So a lot of times, you know, on the Buddha's path, it's about being born and born and born again in samsara. And when I think of being an adolescent, it's like, okay, I get it. You know, it's all right. I don't have to be born again. It's hard from little infant to adolescent to then, you know, going into our more maturing years. The aging process, a lot of us in the Dharma are in that grouping now, where we're feeling the aches and pains of the body, and things are going more, as they say, downhill. I don't know how else to, I wish it was like downhill easy, but it's not that easy in a way. There's so much more time you have to spend in taking care of yourself. You have to take this for your eyes and that for your aches and pains and another thing for your hair, you know, like lucky thing there's henna, you know, or else you'd see a lot more white. So all those things that, I mean, that are kind of a pain, but they're there. And then a lot of us have been actually sick or been around people who have been sick, and the dukkha of that, the dukkha, the suffering of being sick, and the hardness of that for those who are the caretakers as well as those, of course, who are sick. Give me a moment. And then, of course, dying and the process of dying. I mean, not just death itself, which is in itself a big, huge transition for the person, of course, and for the people around. But the dying process is a beautiful process, a process of letting go oneself and the others, the loved ones, letting go of the one who's leaving. And yet, as much as many of us have had room in our hearts to be with that, with loved ones, and we've actually taken training in that, and I worked in the cemetery and mortuary for 20 years, and my teacher said to me that, having that work is like being in a monastery, because you're constantly exposed to death and the grieving around it. So the dying process and then death. And this is the vulnerability, the hallmarks of vulnerability in our lives. Being with those we like and then being separated from them. Being with those we don't like and then having to be with them, you know. This is all hard, right? And it's all part of being human. We're trying to control it all the time or avoid it all the time. And really what brings the most suffering is that, the trying to control, trying to avoid, wanting it to be different than it really is. instead of putting our energy into, like, can we open to this and learn how to be with this and understand that the truth, the first noble truth of life that the Buddha pointed out was that, dukkha saccha, that those are the two words that signify the first noble truth, which is dukkha means suffering, and it's not, you know, just the suffering of pain in the body, but the suffering of the heartache, what we all go through. It's also the suffering of having pleasant experience, and pleasant experience is also impermanent. It also leaves. So even pleasant experience, you know, when it goes away, there's difficulty there in the heart. So we're all faced with this as human beings. It's part of life, dukkha. Many ways to explain it in the Buddhist teaching. When I looked it up once in the Pali English Dictionary, it was, you know, dictionaries have this very small print, but it was about 4 pages of this big dictionary just trying to explain dukkha. So you can't, in Pali, in the Buddha's understanding of it, it's not just a few words that describe it. So dukkha saccha, saccha means the truth, means the way things are. So when we talk about the First Noble Truth, it's not as misinterpreted as it has been in the West, as life is suffering, but it really is the means the truth of dukkha, that there is this noble truth, and that's what the Buddha started out with. And it was such a relief to me when I came to the Buddha's path, because it was an affirmation of what my life was all about. It wasn't about trying to get someplace else. It first started where my life really is. And it made me realize and feel and be confirmed that this is normal. This understanding of the truth of dukkha is the kind of the place you start at for most people, except the, you know, the rare one that's it's probably not any of us, or we wouldn't be here right now. So this is how it is, how we are in this life. And I'm so grateful that my own teachers didn't brush this aside. It just began with this first noble truth. So it's not to diminish all the beauty in our lives that's there to be enjoyed. It's not to say, oh, we can't enjoy the beauty and the pleasant states of mind. Totally, we're going to enjoy them. But also to know they don't stay, they go away. So when they do go away, it's not such a big disappointment to us. It's the law. It's the law of how things are. It's not unnatural for it to go away. Enjoy it when it's there. It actually makes the enjoyment even more, because we know it doesn't last. So this vulnerability that we open to when we're born and all throughout our lives as a human being is not easy to open to. It's something that we actually need training in. We actually need we need to know how to do this, how to navigate and traverse this area, and especially the more difficult times of our life. And that's why we need to incline the mind towards friendliness, kindliness towards ourselves and others, so that we can bring this into those places of our hearts where we're beginning to realize, maybe for the very beginning, or maybe we've realized it over and over again, and we're bringing more of a wholesome habit pattern to coming to that place where it's painful, and letting the mind just touch that place in the heart, touch that place in the body that feels pain, without pushing it away, because, oh, darn, you know, it's there again. Or then distracting ourselves because we don't want to be there. So we need this kindly attention, not just their attention sometimes, but we need the habit pattern of bringing the soft, gentle, yet clear attention to whatever's happening. So I'd like to speak about the Four Noble Truths, kind of flesh it out a bit this evening, and see where we go with that, and try to understand the necessity of opening to it. In some of his talks, the Buddha brought out the need for compassion to be able to kind of traverse our lives, because there is this dukkha satcha, there is this truth of how it is, these constantly fleeting moments of happiness and the oncoming moments sometimes of pain that we think may not never go away, but they do. Wish we could remember that too, you know, when the pain is there. Carl Jung said, enlightenment doesn't mean envisioning bodies of light. It is making the darkness known. And I loved that when I first heard it about 30 years ago, because it really set the stage for me to turn the attention, to learn to turn the attention to what's difficult, instead of turning away from it or running away from it. Utejaniya again, the moment there is awareness, it replaces not knowing with knowing. The work of awareness is just to know. The work of wisdom is to differentiate between what is skillful and unskillful. So I want to flesh that point out a little bit more. You know, there's a lot of sayings in the Dharma about being present and being in the present moment. But I loved when Utejaniya pointed out to us in retreat one time that it's not enough to be, awareness alone is not enough. Being present alone is not enough. We can be present, but then what do we do with what we open to? Awareness is a precursor to wisdom. So once awareness in the present moment is there, it brings in the wisdom factor. Wisdom and awareness are two different things. Awareness opens to the moment of experience and mirrors it with a clean mirror, where there isn't anything else there, there's just that mirroring of what's going on, that, as we say, pristine awareness of what's happening. So when awareness is there, it brings in the wisdom factor, which is another mind, shall we say, another moment of experience. And that wisdom begins to understand, is this what the awareness is showing? Is this wholesome or unwholesome? Meaning to say, will this lead to happiness or will this lead to suffering? So it differentiates that, it discerns the moment. Is it wholesome, unwholesome? Will it lead to happiness or unhappiness? And when there's more wisdom, which we cultivate by being more and more aware, brings in more and more wisdom. When there's more and more wisdom, then there's the ability to know that if this leads to happiness, we nourish that. We give it more attention, we bring action, we bring words there. So this takes it into our daily life. Or sometimes, you know, when even you're still and a thought or a feeling of metta arises or compassion arises, to notice it, sometimes bringing more light around it, I'll say, oh, this is compassion, or this is loving kindness, or this is calm. All those are all the hallmarks of when your meditation is going in the right direction, in the direction of happiness. So we nourish it if it's wholesome. Maybe we nourish it by just another moment of awareness. So then when the mind or wisdom discerns that it's unwholesome, what we do is notice that and then notice the impermanence of it. We turn the mind to how it's impermanent. That's one powerful way of handling it. And then letting it go, letting it do its thing, which is to go. It dissolves. We don't have to kind of let go. It doesn't happen that way. The mind just sees clearly, and wisdom knows it's doing its thing, it's going. So you just have to be patient and notice how that unwholesome mind state follows the law and just leaves. We don't have to nourish it anymore by saying anything more about it, by trying to figure out if it's about a situation in life. We don't have to figure out who's right or wrong. It's just seeing that unwholesome mind state, say it's hatred, or say it's annoyance, or anything in between. It's just noticing it and not feeding it. I used to say, well, I still do to yogis, don't feed it, just feel it. You know, really feel it. We feed it by saying more, trying to figure it out. But just feeling it. So this is how we can handle things when wisdom is there. It's interesting to note that after the Buddha's enlightenment, on his way to Varanasi, he met an ascetic who was impressed by his radiance and his demeanor and his appearance and his clarity. And so he stopped the Buddha and said, "What have you discovered? You're such a radiant being, and there's something about you that's so deeply peaceful. What is it?" So the Buddha's first words, like some of our teachers like to call it, actually his first talk, his first Dharma talk. The Buddha said to this person, it is said in the suttas, "I am the perfectly enlightened one, the Buddha." And the person who received that information wasn't very enlightened by that information. So he just kind of shrugged his shoulders and took another path. And so then the Buddha, it seems like, and when we look back, it seems like the Buddha must have thought, there must be another way to present this whole system, you know? If I go around just saying I'm enlightened, who's really going to listen to me? Maybe, you know, people who want to drink the Kool-Aid, but, you know, nobody's really going to be impressed by that. So that's when he walked to Sarnath. He went through Varanasi and he went to Sarnath, and that's where he presented his first sermon to the five ascetics. And it said that when he gave that first sermon about the Four Noble Truths, the Dhammacakkappavattana Sutta, there was an enlightenment of maybe two or three, I can't remember, of the ascetics. Maybe there were three, hearing that first talk. And then when he gave his second talk, the other two were also fully enlightened. The second talk was about anatta, the Anatta Lakkhana Sutta. So this was the turning point. This sermon was called the turning of the wheel of the Dhamma, because this is when the understanding of the Dhamma was started to be expressed in this particular world cycle that we're in. There have been other Buddhas in other world cycles, but in this particular world cycle. So he started with this first noble truth. He started with actually where we are. You know, it wasn't like where you want to be, the enlightenment thing, but where we are right now. So we could feel that, you know, we're part of this process. We're not, we're beginning at the very beginning. So I want to read to you some of the words from the sutta. I like to read from the sutta sometimes and just kind of give you a transmission of what comes from way back there, not just my interpretation of it. So this is from the Samyutta Nikaya, and it's about when the Buddha gave that first sermon. Some of his words are purported to be these precise words. The Blessed One was once living in Kosambi. Oh, let me go back to say, this Four Noble Truths was given many, many times, and this is one of the renditions in his words during a time when he gave these Four Noble Truths. He was living in Kosambi at that time, in a wood of some sapa trees. He picked up a few leaves in his hand and he asked the bhikkhus, "How do you conceive this, bhikkhus? Which is more, the few leaves that I've picked up in my hand or those in all the trees in the forest?" "So too, bhikkhus." Oh, sorry. And then the bhikkhu said, "The leaves that the Blessed One has picked up in his hand are few. Those in the forest are far more." "So too, bhikkhus," the Buddha said, "the things that I have known by direct knowledge are more. The things I have known, I have told you, are only a few. Why have I not told them? Because they bring no benefit, no advancement to the holy life, and because they do not lead to dispassion, to fading, to ceasing, to stilling, to direct knowledge, to enlightenment, to nibbana. That is why I have not told you all that I know. And what have I told you? There is the truth of suffering. There is the origin of suffering. There is the cessation of suffering. And there is a way leading to the cessation of suffering. That is what I've told you. Why have I told you? Because it brings benefit and advancement in the holy life. And because it leads to dispassion, to fading, to ceasing, to stilling, to direct knowledge, to enlightenment, to nibbana. So, bhikkhus, let your task be this. This is the truth of suffering. This is the origin of suffering. This is the cessation of suffering. This is the way leading to the cessation of suffering. And that's the way the Buddha presented the Four Noble Truths. Very simply, but we ourselves have to open to them. We can investigate them for ourselves. We can confirm them for ourselves. It's not based on blind belief. These teachings are based on, I hear these words all the time, ehipasiko, come and see for yourself. You may hear what the Buddha taught, but it's up to us to realize it for ourselves. Manindra used to say to me, "I can point the way to the truth, but you yourself have to walk it. I can't do that for you." So it's said that the first noble truth, this dukkha satcha, should be investigated. It should be investigated so it's really understood. It's not like taking somebody else's word for it. It's like understanding it ourselves. The second of the noble truths, I'll go over them all now, but talk more about the first one. There is a cause, and that cause is clinging and craving. This is the cause of suffering. And the Buddha said that this is to be relinquished, to be let go of. Now I know people say, well, all wanting is not bad, is it? I mean, we want to have a good job, of course. We want the Seahawks to win, of course. I couldn't leave that one out. We want that. And is something bad about that? Of course not, you know. But there are wantings, desires, cravings, clinging that lead to suffering. And they're the ones that we know. You know, we need to loosen our grip around this. And it's very hard sometimes to do that. So what are the areas you know for yourself that you need to loosen your grip around? It's mainly, I like the words clinging, you know, clinging, because we may want something, but know that this wanting is leading in the direction of benefit. We want to be generous, we want to be kind, but there are wantings that we really cling to, that we can feel in that very clinging that it's leading to suffering. We feel it right there. And eventually, you know, there is no benefit to that clinging. So relinquishing the cause of suffering, there is a possibility for the ending of dukkha. This is the third noble truth. And that's why the first noble truth, because we have this third one, that's why the first noble truth is not like the ultimate reality. It's not like it's that in our lives all the time, because there's a possibility for it to end. And this is to be realized. Nibbana, the cessation of suffering. There are momentary cessations of suffering, but there is a cessation of suffering when the uprooting of the defilements in the mind are totally uprooted and they don't appear again. So this is the ultimate realization of the ending of suffering. And the fourth noble truth is the cessation of suffering can be attained through the Eightfold Noble Path. When someone asks the Buddha, what is the noble truth of the way leading to the cessation of suffering? And the Buddha answered very succinctly, it is the Noble Eightfold Path. If we follow this path, it leads to the end of suffering. And so I'll lay out that fourth noble truth, the ending of suffering in this Eightfold Noble Path. The first two are called the wisdom factors, the wisdom group, and that's wise understanding or wise view. The second one is wise intention. Of course, if we have that view, understanding in our minds, and our intention is to follow that wise view. Sometimes the second path factor is called wise thought, not necessarily wise intention. And so that wise thought, intention, leads to this second grouping called the virtuous conduct grouping. It is the purification of speech and behavior. So the third path factor is right speech, the fourth is right action or wise action, and the fifth is right livelihood. And the third grouping is called mental development, the development of ways of we can open our minds and train our minds so that it will have a strong basis to actually become more peaceful. That's right effort, right mindfulness, and right concentration. So those are all of the eight right there. So when the Buddha taught there is the truth of suffering, dukkha, saccha, sometimes it's said in this way, there is the noble truth of the Arya Satcha, the noble truth, Arya Satcha. Arya means noble, and sometimes that's translated to mean the ennobling truth, because it brings ordinary people like us, I consider myself an ordinary being and all of us here, it brings us to that noble attainment of really understanding deeply what being noble is all about. You can nobly accept suffering and acknowledge that your life is unfolding in a particular suchness, in a particular way, despite your preference for otherwise. We can see that, oh, it's just this right now. Can I be with just this? So the Buddha's first truth tells us that dissatisfaction is unavoidable. It's part of life. The problem is that we resist opening to it. We don't want to know that. We spend a lot of our lives trying to get away from it. The truth of suffering is a very positive message, actually. When we put it together with there is an end to suffering and there is a path to the end, because we don't have to be at the mercy of it. We don't have to just think all the time that life is about being joyful and we're not there, so something must be wrong with us because we're not there. It lets us know that we're actually pretty normal human beings, that we're not always needing to look for that joyful moment, or that we have to have that joy in our lives all the time. I don't know who John Bennett was, but he wrote this something that was very wise about this. He says, "You come to see that suffering is required, and you can no more want to avoid it than you want to avoid putting your next foot on the ground when you're walking. In the spiritual path, joy and suffering follow one another like 2 feet, and you come to a point of not minding which foot is on the ground. You realize, on the contrary, that it is extremely uncomfortable hopping all the time on the joy foot." So, but some of us just kind of insist that we should be there all the time. And boy, that's a lot of suffering when we do that. So, this empowering us to open to it is that ability to get close to it, which takes compassion. Compassion allows us to come close to whatever is difficult. Not push away, not turn away, not strike out at because it makes you unhappy. And to finally open to whatever the truth of dukkha is for you in that moment. And as we go along on our path, it does become, people say, oh, maybe the dukkha will get lighter, right? I mean, that's kind of the wanting mind, but it actually, sorry to say, but it actually doesn't get lighter. It can get more intense because it's seen more clearly. And those skills that we learn to bring the soft touch to it, the gentle friendliness, the very clear seeing that doesn't allow one to personalize it, the ability to know what's needed at that time for balance, all of that is needed as we go along. We learn those ways quite spontaneously, quite naturally. So in the Tibetan tradition, they say that for an ordinary person, the state of suffering is like when you have a grain of sand on the palm of your hand. You don't really know that it is suffering because it doesn't really bother you in the palm of your hand. You know, maybe you can even rub it and not too bad. But they say that when you go deeper in the practice and have higher sensitivity and sense the reality of the world, what was formerly pleasurable is like a grain of sand in your eye. It becomes really noticeable. You really feel it. Your sensitivity to dukkha is much greater, but also your strengths to be able to face that dukkha are also much greater if you employ them and if you develop them along the way. It bothers you much more, this grain of sand in your eye. That's when you are aware of the truth of suffering and you're not putting anything in between. It's really just facing it. So unless we learn all these other skillful ways, it's going to be really tremendously difficult to face all of that. One of us asked, and I asked one time, Manindraji, about suffering, does it become more difficult? And he said, yes, that's why we need equanimity, because we really need to not react to it so much. If we don't have equanimity, which is based in loving kindness, then our reactivity to our suffering is so hard on us. And when I remember once in a very difficult retreat, it was so difficult that I just wanted to leave. But I was far away from home and I couldn't leave. And then I went to Upandita and I kind of fell on the floor in a puddle crying, and I said, I really can't face this. It's just too much. I really can't face this. Seeing things I'd never seen before come and go and all of that. And he guided me through that. And okay. So at the end, when I was leaving, I said, will I ever go through this again? And he said, no, you won't. So I went on my way, and then I went to another retreat with him. And the dukkha was there again, you know. And I said, you told me that I would never have to experience this again, you know. And he said, it's not the same dukkha. It's really because everything changes. It's totally different now, you know. And also, there was a seeing it more closely, but sometimes you really need a teacher to help you to gather everything you can to really just open to it. So I read this poem actually in one of my colleagues' articles about noble truth. And this was in Tanisara's article in Tricycle recently. She wrote a beautiful article about dukkha. And she mentioned Mark Nepple's poem, which really says it all. So he says, having loved enough and lost enough, I am no longer searching, just opening, no longer trying to make sense of pain, but being a soft and sturdy home in which real things can land. These are the irritations that rub to a pearl. So a soft and sturdy home in which real things can land. You know, can our heart be like that, where it can be there. This can be here and can open to it. And it's a place where, you know, those irritations kind of make one's heart shiny, rubbed to a pearl. So all the discomfort, the subtle anxiety, the restlessness, and the thoughts and the feelings of nothing is lastingly satisfying. We're seeing this moment by moment in our practice. We're realizing that first noble truth. Our first instinct is to move away from it. In our sitting, in our life, we want to distract ourselves from it. Of course, it's so hard, you know. The consumer world we live in has taken advantage of this, not to blame the consumer world, we're part of it, but but have built industries based on keeping us distracted. So a big part of our attention is learning just to bring it back, just to bring it back, so we're not pulled here and there, distracted. And we can distract ourselves in many ways. It doesn't have to be, you know, the stores. It can be spiritual beliefs, you know, that whole spiritual bypassing thing where we think we're doing something to bypass, to face what we need to face, but we're really bypassing it somehow, using some spiritual understanding that is not the right take on it. So there's been a lot written about that. One of the most interesting books lately is one by Robert Augustus Masters, and that's the name of it, Spiritual Bypassing. So when we constantly chase after joy and not know that chasing after also is dukkha, when we're constantly running away from dukkha and really getting so identified with it that it's another layer of dukkha. When we're projecting or blaming it on others, that's dukkha. Not so much for the others, but the projecting and the blaming is the dukkha in our own hearts. To project them onto oneself and feel like we're a personal failure, that too is, of course, a lot of dukkha there. Or we turn it into something that we lead into life with. Like, you know, I've got so much pain based on this or that, something in the body, something in our belief system. I've got so much pain. And then we lead into life with that pain. So in this activity of really complex reactions to everyday experience, we fail to face dukkha and accept the truth of it just as it is, instead of all these ways that we navigate through the muddy and rough waters. So can we be a soft and sturdy home in which real things can land? Like my friend says, if we can feel it, we can heal it. So these Four Noble Truths are essentially the starting point of the teachings that the Buddha gave, the container to really understand them. The first one is to investigate the truth of dukkha, and the second one to that there is a cause and we can know that cause, and that cause is clinging, and it's to relinquish that clinging. The third cause, the third truth is that there is an end to dukkha and it can be realized. And that's what our life is for, is to realize the end of dukkha. And the fourth is the Eightfold Noble Path. So when we're here in our practice today, this is what we're constantly opening to. And sometimes we think we're just wrong, you know, we're doing it wrong because we don't feel calm, we don't feel concentrated, we don't feel peaceful. But we're really opening to those noble truths, and we really have to take that experience in. So the hallmark of good practice is not necessarily a calm mind all the time, or a place where we feel peaceful all the time, or where we're feeling loving kindness. Those come sometimes, and we can feel them for short moments or long moments. But really the hallmark is opening to the pain that we feel, even momentarily when we're sitting here, letting the moments of happiness come, knowing that they go. So when we know the noble truths, we also know that nothing lasts. And with regard to the qualities and the skillful ways that we can handle them, loving kindness and compassion, the Buddha says this also, that for one who mindfully develops boundless loving kindness, seeing the destruction of clinging, the fetters are worn away. The fetters that kind of hold us to suffering. So loving kindness, he's saying directly in this quote, that loving kindness is enabling us to see the end of holding on, because loving kindness is letting go, it's opening with that kind of love. So the Buddha spoke about this many times in his life, over and over again, needing to, our great deep need to take this in as human beings, this suchness, this the way it is, and to be able to bring a sense of the quality of acceptance to it. And this is our practices of the practices of the Brahma Viharas, loving kindness, compassion, sympathetic joy, equanimity. So I'd like to end with this two phrases by Wendell Berry. To go in the dark with the light is to know the light, is to know the way to the end of suffering. So we're going into understanding that, and it may be difficult to go to the dark place, but remember that we're going with awareness, and we're going with wisdom that's developing, and that's the light, and that's what we'll know. So let's sit for a moment with that. So just letting the words all dissolve, if they're still ruminating around. And just bring your attention to being present with whatever's happening in the body. The energy processes of thinking, just let it go through. Thank you for your kind attention.